Hi, I'm David Freudberg, host of Humankind. Listeners know that we explore many realms of the human journey, and some of our podcasts, including some of my favorites, delve into wisdom traditions, sometimes ancient writings or teachings that arise from a variety of backgrounds, sources that help us to focus on truths that really matter. And a lot of this boils down to connecting to something bigger than ourselves, to see that we're all part of some mysterious river of meaning, that the whole is truly greater than the sum of its parts. When I can get calm and touch that inner place of quietude, it points me homeward. Thank you. Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund and a special grant from the Henry Luce Foundation.
I've known colleagues, young and old, who become completely absorbed in the technical problems they're working with, and you can understand that. They're fascinating problems. And I have to say that by and large, the scientific community has indeed attempted to gain its technical success before asking about the social and moral implications of what that success will bring.
The clash of science and ethics when talented researchers develop terrible weapons that are used against civilians. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. The question we always ask is, how could this happen? That was the world's reaction in August 2013 when disturbing images surfaced of civilians, including many children, lying lifeless after poison gas attacks in the suburbs of Damascus, Syria. But military use of dreadful arms always occurs after people devoted a lot of brain power and effort to developing the weapons in the first place. Historian Robert Neer took me on a tour of Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This is the location of a top-secret basement research laboratory that was created by the university in 1942 to house Professor Louis Fieser, who was a genius and a very prominent member, although quite young still, of the Harvard chemistry faculty, and a select group of assistants that had been assembled by him to conduct government-financed war research on first poison gas, but then later incendiary weapons. The initial task was to develop a kind of thickening agent for gasoline based on rubbers. But after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor cut off much of the rubber supply to the United States, the research turned to finding chemical alternatives for rubber that could be used to produce gelled weapons that are very sticky and consequently more effective at starting fires.
The Imperial Japanese Navy's assault on Hawaii ignited World War II. This heightened the urgency of American weapons researchers, who were also eyeing the ominous march of Nazi Germany through Europe.
On Valentine's Day 1942, Fieser and his team notified the government that they had developed a formulation that they called napalm.
A quarter century later, the use of napalm, a sticky gel that causes severe burns to human skin, would come to symbolize the brutality of the Vietnam War, especially in its horrific impact on civilian peasants. The weapon's development, which tapped the minds of gifted scientists, is chronicled in Robert Neer's book, Napalm, An American Biography.
Chemists have been at work and war engineers since the 1940s, and newer napalms burn even hotter and are even more sticky than earlier napalms.
How hot are we talking about?
About 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, approximately.
2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah. So that's hotter than anything that most people are likely to come in contact with in their normal course of existence. But it's not the heat that's the real problem, as it were, or the really devastating thing. The real problem is that it's sticky, so that it will burn and then continue to burn and be very hard to stop burning as it continues down into someone's skin. Experiments that have been done by military researchers indicate, not surprisingly, that even a very small amount of napalm placed on someone's shirt would very soon, within a few seconds, create excruciating pain as it burned through the cloth and into the skin. And if the blob of napalm is large enough, it can continue to burn all the way down to the bone.
The first field test of a napalm bomb occurred on July 4, 1942, at the Harvard College soccer field. A photo of the test site shows people playing tennis on nearby courts. Other experiments involved gel packed around gunpowder, which was detonated in a remote area of Everett, Massachusetts, a working-class town about 5 miles outside Cambridge. Eventually, the scientists had refined napalm to the point where it could be mass-produced.
During World War II, a variety of companies, about a half a dozen, produced napalm because the government was trying to make as much as possible. As soon as the military forces saw it in operation in World War II, they wanted to get more. In fact, in Japan, when it was first used against the city of Tokyo on the 9th of March, 1945, it was judged to be so effective that particular attack killed more people than any other in the history of the world, more even than the atomic explosions at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the commanders felt that that was such a victory that they would continue to use as much napalm as they could, as quickly as they could.
Over 100,000 humans were killed as wave after wave of bombers came in and dropped both incendiary bombs, napalm, and explosives.
Everett Mendelsohn is emeritus professor of the history of science at Harvard. He came to the university a decade after napalm was invented there. Dr. Mendelsohn has long studied and taught about the social implications of scientific research.
We knew of how this material, napalm, had been used. It had been used in the firebombing of cities, Dresden, Hamburg, the two in which the nature of war had been proven to be changed. Instead of bombing specific military or strategic targets, you now bombed whole cities. And you drop napalm on those cities as a way to wipe out the manner in which daily life was lived. As I recall, Winston Churchill called it, we wanted to de-house the residents of those towns. So napalm was not new to us.
Anti-war demonstrators protest U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War in mass marches, rallies, and demonstrations. Central Park is the starting point for the parade to the U.N. building. The estimated 125,000 Manhattan marchers include students, housewives, beatnik poets, doctors, businessmen, teachers, priests, and nuns.
In 1967, a year when the anti-Vietnam War movement gained momentum in America, Everett Mendelsohn was one of over 100 Boston-area professors to sign a newspaper ad supporting students who protested campus recruitment by Dow Chemical Corporation, the chief supplier of napalm.
The image that was strongest in the minds of those of us who had looked at it and knew something of its history was that it was noncombatants who turned out to be the major targets. If you used napalm on a military installation, people would not have worried about it much. But when you use it as an instrument for burning out whole cities in which non-combatants lived, you became more and more worried. So that when they began using napalm in Vietnam, our antennae went up. We were aware of the fact that this meant that they were broadening the targets and they were going to, be careless in whether they were going after military installations or human residences.
This way of settling differences is not just.
Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at the Riverside Church, New York City, April 1967.
This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love.
One of the most vivid and haunting depictions of napalm was that famous photograph of a young girl named Kim Phuc, taken in South Vietnam in June of 1972. Can you just tell us about that?
A South Vietnamese airplane appeared badly off course and dropped several napalm bombs, one of which caught Kim in a fire cloud and burned her over more than half of her body and her back and her head, so that when the picture was taken, she was running burned naked because of the fire that had enveloped her and with portions of her skin still burning.
She was 9 years old.
She was 9 years old.
She's now about 50 years old, living in Canada. Have you been in contact with her?
I have been. She very kindly spoke to me a number of times about her experiences and said that she was filled with rage after what happened to her because it was so unjust. What possible basis could there be for practically burning alive a 9-year-old? And over decades, she came to the personal realization that that rage was actually destructive to her. And so she found God, converted to Christianity, found enormous comfort through that belief, and forgave the people who had done this to her in every context.
We're exploring ethical questions around the role of scientists in developing powerful weapons for military use. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this topic and to obtain an audio download, please visit humanmedia.org. You mentioned earlier Louis Fieser, this chemist on the faculty of Harvard, a chemistry prodigy who led the scientific development of napalm. He was a paradoxical figure. He served on the Surgeon General's panel many years later that declared tobacco harmful to health, yet he developed a weapon that largely became a pariah and was decried as inhuman by many.
Fieser himself, I don't think, saw that as a paradox. Not then, not later.
Historian Robert Neer, author of Napalm.
He said, for example, in response to questions that swirled around him during the anti-napalm demonstrations in the 1960s, when this question was put with a vigor and a force which is scarcely imaginable to contemporaries, the passions of the debate that occurred in the 1960s. And when students at Harvard protested the manufacture of napalm by Dow Chemical and the recruitment of Harvard students to go work at Dow Chemical in demonstrations that shut down the chemistry buildings where Fieser's office was and close to the place where the research had been done that invented this substance, Fieser himself said that he had no responsibility at all for the inhumane uses of napalm, such as they may have been. The analogy that he drew was to the gun manufacturer, who he said was not responsible for the assassination of President Kennedy.
The moral question seemed to turn on whether a weapon developed in a military-funded laboratory and quickly deployed in war could be considered a neutral object, in the same way that, say, a common kitchen knife could be used for either slicing vegetables or slitting someone's throat. Science historian Everett Mendelson says that questions about the ethics of research came to haunt many of the scientists who converged on Los Alamos, New Mexico in World War II to develop the atomic bomb, a research project launched the same year that napalm was invented at Louis Fieser's lab in Cambridge.
I arrived at Harvard as a graduate student in 1953. He was still quite active, and I even sat in on his organic chemistry course, not for credit, but to increase my knowledge of organic chemistry because I wanted to go on and do some work in biochemistry. So that I saw him three times a week for the better part of a year.
What was he like?
He was a very positive man, and that you could tell even by his lecturing style. His reputation was one of being extremely agile as an experimenter, very inventive, of having a somewhat authoritarian personality. He didn't brook disagreements easily, and being a very effective teacher.
He disavowed any responsibility for inhumane use of napalm. How do you feel about that?
Well, I take it with a grain of salt. Remember that marvelous Tom Lehrer song about the German scientists? And remember his line in that one song, "Once the rockets go up, I don't care where they come down. That's not my department," said Wernher von Braun. Scientists can't escape from the responsibility for things that they create. They may, in later life, want to disavow their own work. To some extent, J. Robert Oppenheimer became deeply, deeply concerned about what he had done as director of the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project. Any number of other scientists who were physicists, particularly who'd worked on that project, came away in the years immediately after the Second World War, feeling a sense of personal guilt and repugnance at what they had done. Many of them probably hadn't thought through until very close to the end of the atomic bomb project that the bomb would actually work and that it would be used, and that it would be used against largely civilian populations.
I'm sorry, so this entire complex at Los Alamos was created, a couple $1 billion spent on developing the bomb in the Manhattan Project. And yet people who had moved there, who were working on it daily as a scientific problem, had not imagined its ultimate use?
Yes and no. Some had, some hadn't. Again, the context, the war in Germany, the barbarity of that war. There was zero sympathy for Hitler and his armies. It's in that context that these physicists, many of them young, not all, some senior physicists, but it was in this context that they were working. A number of their key compatriots working at Los Alamos were German refugees, scientists who'd escaped Germany, either because they were anti-Nazi or both because they were Jewish. So that the mood at Los Alamos through making the bomb, through bringing it to being, was one in which we're looking for our technical success. That's what we want. When it came to the last months, when they was clear they were going to successfully make a bomb, some began to worry. And again, some petitions were circulated among the group who were its makers, urging that some alternate means be found to warn the Japanese so that they would surrender.
That ghostly shading on the bridge walk is the only remaining evidence of what was once a man. The bomb blast consumed his body entirely, but cast his imprint on the stones where he stood to meet his fate. Science still seeks to uncover the complete secret of the mighty atom's power.
For most of the scientists, right up to its use, they were focused on would it work.
And so how do you understand what appears to be a kind of disconnect between people preoccupied with a technical puzzle that they are brilliantly working their way through and the actual ramifications of technologies that they succeed in creating?
This, of course, is a continuing tension for scientists, for discoverers or inventors in many fields, particularly ones in which some product is created which can affect the lives of others. And it's in that context that people, trained scientists, practitioners, want to have their technical success. And then for many, let's have our technical success and worry about the implications after it. And this was the general attitude, I think, among many of the bomb makers during the Second World War.
In It may be hard to fathom how scientists selected for their high intelligence for a project to develop powerful armament can fail to come to grips with the moral dimensions of their research work. Is it that people get swept up in the fervor and fear of wartime? Is there an element of denial at the horrible consequences of weapons being developed? Whatever the reasons, figuring out the science seemed to take priority. Author Robert Neer.
Among other preparations that the Army made were to build model German and Japanese residences. Later in the process, there was testing on factories, but the majority of the testing of napalm was against residential houses. German ones were designed with three different types of roofs to reflect different architectural customs in different parts of Germany, in the Rhineland and in eastern Germany. The Japanese houses were designed to reflect typical Japanese workers' residences. Archeo Studios was involved because their set design people had a lot of experience making sets as realistically as possible. In the case of the German houses, the government actually reopened a furniture factory in upstate New York to get furniture that was just to the type that was used in Germany, and then furnished the rooms accordingly.
So if they were testing napalm on structures that were intentionally built to emulate residential homes, did they not anticipate that there would be an effect of the use of this weapon on civilians?
It's hard to imagine that there wouldn't have been. There's no explicit discussion of that I found, but these were houses complete with everything except for the people in them.
I remember Daniel Ellsberg, who in the early 1970s disclosed the Pentagon Papers, which was a study of over 40 volumes compiled by the Pentagon itself, reconstructing the government decision-making around the Vietnam War. And Ellsberg said that nowhere in the Pentagon Papers did there seem to be a discussion of the impact of the war-making procedures and policies on the civilian population of Vietnam.
I think that my research with respect to the engineers and the people that were involved with the production of the weapon running straight through the people who were designing these model villages that we've just been discussing, it was very similar to Mr. Ellsberg's conclusion. This was a research problem that had to be solved.
There were, of course, scientists in the 1940s who harbored moral reservations about weapons development, but something changed profoundly, existentially, in World War II. The intersection of mass-scale warfare and advanced technology brought humanity to a turning point. The atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, in August 1945, ushered in a frightening age. For the first time, mass destruction was now an option available to war makers. Science historian Everett Mendelsohn.
Several years after the Second World War, a whole scientist movement sprang up, trying to gain civilian control over the weapons, trying to move to some sort of international control to make sure that these weapons wouldn't spread and that they would never be used again. So scientists did get deeply involved. They didn't have great success because of the Cold War, and in a sense, they faded away. Life back in the laboratory absorbed them, with the exception of a few. They did found a scientist organization. The Federation of Atomic Scientists became the Federation of American Scientists. They established the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists with that famous doomsday clock of how many minutes to midnight were you coming. And during the Cold War, the period of the 50s and early 60s, scientists were caught in the middle. You'll remember this is the period of Senator Joseph McCarthy. This was the period of the House Un-American Affairs Committee, in which scientists were called up to testify before Congress and were pilloried. Any number of people, particularly if they were young and without tenure at the universities, lost their jobs because they were not sympathetic enough to the American side of the Cold War.
So did that atmosphere encourage people to kind of put on blinders about the moral implications of what they were doing?
I'd say for most people, or for many people at least, the answer is definitely yes. They blinded themselves to things outside what they were doing in the laboratories. And to some extent, I'd have to say that the blinders were pushed back in part by the young people. During the rise of the anti-Vietnam War movement, young people forced those questions upon their elders. And it's in that context, I think, that the petition you mentioned, signed by professors here at Harvard and petitions around the country, the context in which they developed a newfound sense that, we have to at least live up to the expectations that our students and our young people are creating for us.
Is there anything in the scientific process, the research process, that can insulate people from moral reflection?
Yes and no. I've known colleagues, young and old, who become completely absorbed in the technical problems they're working with. And you can understand that. They're fascinating problems. They are issues which take them right out to the edge of their knowledge, and they have to push to gain more and more. It's exciting. And you watch it, and you can just feel as you sit down at lunch with them, or you'll have a glass of wine in the evening, you can feel the intense attention being given to this scientific problem that they're engaged in. The implications of what they're doing, some pick it up easily, others figure someone else will deal with that. And they hold back. They don't let it get in the way of their work. And I have to say that by and large, the scientific community has indeed attempted to gain its technical success before asking about the social and moral implications of what that success will bring.
And sometimes the social and moral implications are rather dire.
Very definitely. I mean, Hiroshima and Nagasaki are a clear example, and Hamburg and Dresden and Tokyo are clear examples of the napalm influence.
So what I'm wondering about as you talk is whether there is something in scientific inquiry that reduces things to an abstraction, which can make it hard to understand the human level of decisions that are being made, actions that are being taken, policies that are being implemented.
I'd say at the core of knowing in science, you do want to strip those away. You want to deal directly with the technical elements. Part of what any number of us have done in our courses, like I did in mine, is to bring back into the calculus of students, of scientists, the fact that they've got to regularly ask, what comes of this? Where is it going? What's its meaning? What's going to be affected by it? Is it good? Is it bad? Or is it potential for good and potential for bad?
Science historian Everett Mendelsohn. Louis Fieser, the Harvard chemist who led the research project that developed napalm, died in 1977. 3 years later, the UN Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons outlawed the use of napalm on civilians. The provision covering napalm was signed by President Barack Obama on his first full day in office in 2009. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart Rose. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Mark Kilstein, David McDevitt, and Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with Connie Goldman Productions. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment, The Clash of Science and Ethics, is Humankind program number 200.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
To hear more episodes of Humankind, you can subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast player. A new episode each week. The podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you enjoy this program, be sure to leave us a kind review at iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to support the program, please visit humanmedia.org. And at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org. Thanks.